We'll go ahead and call to order the House Subcommittee on Higher Education for today, which is Tuesday, February 15th. We will also go ahead and open an informational meeting for an overview of our higher education system. And today we're going to start by hearing about the Oregon Student Assistant Commission, and we also have some individuals from the Oregon Healthcare Education area of our higher ed system as well. So I'd like to call Josette Green and Vicki Merkel and Susan Dagan and Alan Contreras to the dais if they can fit, or they can go in whatever order makes sense for them. We'll let you guys situate yourselves accordingly and go ahead when you're ready and identify yourselves, please, for the record, and take it away.
Okay. Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Dembro, Co-Chair Johnson, and members of the House Higher Education Subcommittee. I'm Josette Green, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, and we're delighted to be here today at your invitation to share with you who is the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. With me, we have an esteemed group of individuals. First, Susan Dagan, who is our Oregon Opportunity Grant Administrator. Susan's to my immediate left. On the other side, Vicki Merkel, who is the Scholarship and Access Program Director. And behind us is Alan Contreras, who's the Office of Degree Authorization Administrator. So we are pleased to be here, and thank you so much for this invitation today. You have four pieces of information that we brought with us that's in front of you. And so two of the pieces, the top two, will be utilized through our presentation. The bottom two are for your reading pleasure at another time. We will not be referencing those two pieces, but we brought those to give you more background information on our agency. I joined the agency in October, and I moved here from Florida to lead the charge for the state financial aid here in Oregon. And I have to tell you, it has been an absolute pleasure to be here. And there's two things I want you to know before we get into the actual who is OSAC, is that this agency is one who is a national leader. We're a national leader. I can point out Vicki Merkel, the second person from my left, is the national chair of state agencies, the association that deals with state agencies, a national chair. Alan Contreras, behind me, is quoted nationally almost monthly on the area of ODA, or the Office of Degree Authorization. These two individuals are known across the nation. We also are an agency of innovative programs, and you're going to hear about that in a few minutes. But we have a scholarship program and Aspire program, both to be better defined for you, that are the only like kind of programs in the nation. You'll learn a little bit more why. So in our precious state, Oregon takes the lead in a number of ways. I think it's important to point out. Okay. So what you have before you, and I'm referencing this piece of information, and we're going to go by the page numbers in the lower right corner of each of the individual slides. You see our content today. I will give a brief overview of who is OSAC, and we affectionately call it OSAC, Oregon Student Assistance Commission. We will go through and tell you about each of the individual programs, and we'll close by talking about trends nationally and within our state and the future of OSAC. So if you will turn to screen three, slide three, the mission. What is the purpose of OSAC? We have two missions written in one mission statement, but I've split it apart to make this more understandable. First, we're here to assist Oregon students and their families in attaining a post-secondary education. We are the only state agency that has sole dedication to that's about accessing higher education. So we work with families and students to ensure that they get on to higher education. We do that by helping them with funding to afford it, and we do it through coaching and mentoring so that they can understand the process of getting to higher education. And that process, of course, entails understanding all the educational institutions out there, the kind of programs, what fits for that student, let alone how to apply for financial aid, how to apply for admissions. So that's our first mission. And the second part, thanks to also housing the Office of Degree Authorization. We are there to enhance the value, integrity, and diversity of Oregon's college programs. So those are the two missions that we fulfill for this state. Slide 4, as I mentioned, we are the only state agency solely dedicated to accessing higher education. Our governor, Governor Kitzhaber, has indicated he has two primary missions, and of course we fulfill one of those and are already on the ground running and making it happen. I want to indicate, too, that we have had a change in agency leadership. Obviously, I've introduced myself as someone who arrived in October. We've also added some new commissioners, which I will talk about in a minute. But we've done that so that we can strengthen who we are as an agency and to be able to move forward in a positive way. You also have a sheet, and I want to talk a little bit about how we are structured. And you have a sheet that talks about our commissioners. We are an agency that reports to a commission. It's a 7-person volunteer commission. Bart Howard is our chair. He's served on the commission for a couple of years. Cap Sharples is our vice chair. Cap was a high school counselor and worked very closely with Representative Robel. And then we also have Glenda Melton, who is a school principal. Alethea Miller is a student commissioner. Ben Eckstein, also a student commissioner. Mike Holland, who was a community college president. And Gary Weeks, who has served a number of roles within the state here in Oregon. And so we have a very esteemed group of commissioners. They meet about 10 times a year, and they serve a number of functions. And one of the reasons I'm pointing this out is that currently there's a bill, Senate Bill 242, that seeks to abolish our 7-person commission. And so speaking with Representative Dembro today, it was suggested that I just highlight this for you to give you a little background in preparation for understanding that bill. And to help you understand the role that our commissioners serve is that the role that only these commissioners can do is to hire the executive director. They are our student appeals and the school appeals board. They are the approving body for rules. They serve as the audit committee for our agency. They serve as the adverse impact committee. They levy fines on the use of fake degrees. They can at any time rescind the Office of Degree Authorization approval of the school programs. They also approve each year the Oregon Opportunity Grant awarding parameters. Those are among, and this is probably not an exhaustive list, but that just gives you an idea. They are our governing body. So while we are an agency, we need that governance, and this is the role they play.
One question, please. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry to interrupt. First of all, why would you leave Florida to come to Oregon? But don't have to answer that.
Because it's Oregon.
Snakes are smaller.
No, and that was just for fun. But are the commissioners paid full-time? How do they get that job?
Okay. Representatives Dembro Johnson and Representative Lindsay, thank you for the question. They are volunteers. What they do have are their expenses covered for attending meetings. And I believe, let me confer here, do they receive a small fee, $30 for each meeting? No?
Per diem, I think it's
per diem.
It's for transportation.
Okay. So, yes, it is just their individual costs for attending the functions and meetings of the agency. Otherwise, they are volunteers.
Thank you.
All right. So very little cost to the state, but yet what they perform for our agency is a very, very important function. So. And to give you a few more highlights about OSAC, in the 9/11 biennium, to tell you overall, we provided $134 million in support for our students to attend post-secondary education. And as far as providing the guidance and mentoring that I referenced, we made contact with about 137,000 high school students and utilized over 2,600 volunteers in this current biennium through our Aspire program, which is known as Access to Student Assistance Programs in Reach of Everyone. And that provides guidance and mentoring to help individuals move on to post-secondary education. We are an agency with 32 individuals working in the office, and screen 5 shows you our basic organizational chart, although I know it's a little difficult to read, but that gives you an idea of our structure and who we are. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Susan Deegan.
For the record, my name is Susan Deegan, Representative Dembro and Representative Johnson, committee members. I am the administrator for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. I'm also the manager for most of the publicly funded programs at the commission. So I'll be talking to you first about the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program, and then a little bit later we will talk a little bit about the public programs as well. The Oregon Opportunity Grant Program is Oregon's state-funded need-based grant program. The application for that program is the free application for federal student aid, affectionately known as the FAFSA by all the parents and high school students who have the pleasure of filling out that form every year. And I am a parent who has done that now, so I am in the club.
We just did ours 1 month ago.
Yes, yes. And as I understand it, it's considerably easier now than it used to be.
It's all digital now.
Yes. Students automatically apply for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program when they complete the FAFSA. They don't have to complete any other application forms at all. The opportunity grant funds are awarded first come, first served. Students begin applying in January 1st for awards that are decided on usually in the spring for enrollment fall term. So we are right at the start of the awarding season. The grant is available for the equivalent of 4 years at full-time enrollment. We do make half-time awards. Those awards can be prorated, so it's not 4 consecutive years. It's a total of the equivalent of 4 years at either full-time or half-time enrollment. There are a number of eligibility requirements in addition to the basic rules. Students must be a U.S. citizen or permanent resident. They must also be an Oregon resident. They have to be enrolled in an eligible program at an eligible 2 or 4 year public or private nonprofit Oregon institution. That is an institution that is located and headquartered in Oregon. Undergraduate students, they have to be undergraduate students. They cannot have a prior baccalaureate degree. And they have to be enrolled at least half-time. They also are not eligible if they have defaults in student loans or if they owe refunds in any kind of federal student grants. They also have to comply with federal selective service registration if they're male, and they have to comply with current drug conviction rules. And the main reason for these requirements is that there's a small amount of federal funds that are included in the funds we use for the Opportunity Grant Program, so we need to make sure that students comply with federal rules as well as any state requirements. Students also have to maintain satisfactory academic progress. In slide number 8 in your handout, you have a copy of the basic formula that we are currently using to determine award amounts and student eligibility for the opportunity grant. The average cost of education, that is the total of tuition and fees, books and supplies, housing costs, and then there's a small miscellaneous amount that most student budgets include for things like transportation. So we take that average cost of education, we collect that information from all the participating colleges and universities in Oregon. We collect that every year, and we use that information to determine what the average cost of education is for the type of school the student's attending, either a community college or a public four-year institution. From that total cost of education, we subtract the student share, the family share, and the federal share. The student share is essentially based on earnings from a part-time job. Currently, the student share is $5,400. That's based upon a part-time job for 48 weeks a year at 15 hours a week. at Oregon minimum wage. Currently it's $5,400. It will be going up to $5,500 next year because the Oregon minimum wage has increased. The student share is $8,500 for students attending four-year institutions. The $8,500 includes an assumption that students will also be borrowing approximately $3,000 in loans for each year of their 4 years as eligible students. The family share is the expected family contribution that's calculated from the financial data on the FAFSA. The federal share is a combination of Pell Grant eligibility and a portion of tax credits that students are expected to have filed for, their families have filed for. After you do all those subtractions, you end up with the state share, which in the basic shared responsibility model formula would be the amount of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. Obviously, we have not had sufficient funds to be able to fully fund the program at that level, so we have had to make income or award limits for each year of the program.
A couple of quick questions while you're in this area. Backing you up to the bottom of slide 7, how do you quantify satisfactory academic progress?
Satisfactory academic progress, according to the federal definition, is something that is determined by the individual participating institutions. They look at grades.
Institution has its own standard.
Yeah. Students who are on academic probation may or may not be considered to be making satisfactory academic progress. And each of the individual schools that participate do monitor that at least annually. Some of them monitor it every term.
Okay. One other question then. Based on the student's share of the their contribution, if it's based on the minimum wage and the minimum wage increases, that then raises the amount of the student's share that they would be able to earn and so forth, but that would also affect the total amount of money left over in the pool, correct? Unless state funding somehow changes accordingly as well, correct?
Co-Chair Johnson, that is correct.
Right.
Yeah. When you look at the entire formula, in many cases, the cost of attendance is increasing far more than the $100 increase in the student share that we'll be seeing from this year to next academic year.
Any other questions right now? Oh, yes, Rick. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you could paint a little bit better picture for me on the needs-based. What are the numbers to qualify for needs-based, number one? And then number two, if you could clarify on slide 8, I'm assuming that you pick up all the remaining. It says the state share opportunity grant. Is that, you might start with the average, minus, 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 equals. Does that mean all whatever's left over, you pick up the rest?
Co-chairs, Representative Lindsay. First, the definition of need-based. That essentially is looking at the family finances of the individual students who are filing for federal financial aid. And it's a formula-driven process. Financial need is essentially the expected family contribution. The lower the expected family contribution, usually the lower the income of the student or the student's family. So we do have students who have zero expected family contribution. I have also seen students who have expected family contributions of $100,000. So it's very much based upon the family finances and their ability to pay.
And a follow-up before you hit my number two.
Yeah.
So expected family finances, that would be an equation versus reality, right? So we can't get families gaming the system by someone that makes $150,000 saying, I'm not going to pay my kids anything. It's based on some sort of equation.
Representative Lindsay, co-chairs, yes. In fact, it is a federal methodology that is used. That's a formula. It's a very large formula, as a matter of fact. And people cannot just say, parents cannot say, no, I am not going to pay, and assume that the state and the federal government will be providing financial aid for their children. In most cases, families up to, for students who are aged under age 24, are expected to provide support for their children. The family is the first source of funding for financial aid for college and paying for college.
Okay. I could just add, you know, as a parent who just did it, you know, it's based on your IRS, what you send in the IRS based on your income for the previous year and so forth. So you really just go right down, take off the information and send it to FAFSA, and that's basically how it works.
You find out that in some people's eyes, you're fabulously wealthy and
a lot of money. Right.
It's pretty amazing.
Different perspectives, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Many of the students who take advantage of the opportunity grant have no family support, right? They're self-supporting. They're older students. And so in their case, they would just be, you would just be looking at the student share, and probably their tax credits would be fairly minimal if they're, you know, doing a low-income job. So they're going to be, you know, potentially the opportunity grant would be very, very large, except that there's a limit to it, isn't there? Isn't there a limit to the individual allocation?
Yeah. Co-chairs, yes. And to answer Representative Lindsay's question, yes, currently the award limits, the maximum award is $1,950 for students attending a four-year public or private institution and $1,800 for a community college student. The award amounts have actually gone down this year compared to the last 2 years.
Just to clarify, that's $1,950 or $1,850 per semester?
No, that's per academic year.
Per academic year.
Yeah.
And that was $1,800?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Okay. Okay. The rest of my presentation, co-chairs, members of the committee, the rest of my presentation is a series of graphs. What I've given you are three different ways of looking at the effect of the economy on the opportunity grant program over time. The first of these graphs, this is the one on slide 9 or page 9, this essentially tracks the number of applications for federal financial aid. This is the number of applications for students who, in theory, could be considered for the Oregon Opportunity Grant each academic year. And that is plotted against the unemployment rate for the same period. And you will notice that there is a definite pattern that, in fact, the financial aid applications track rather closely in some cases with what the current unemployment rate is in Oregon. And what we have found, especially from research that some students in a couple of economic students at the University of Oregon did, was that when the economy in Oregon starts to decline, you see an increase in FAFSAs about 6 months later, and that increase in FAFSAs or applications for financial aid doesn't begin to decline again until about a year after the economy begins to recover. And that makes a lot of sense if you consider unemployment benefits that extend for 6 to 9 months in many cases, although this year has been an exception. And then at the back end, students waiting until they've completed their program before they re-enter the workforce again. The next graph gives you a little bit of a picture on the kind of expenditures the program has had, and the bars represent the amount of funding for the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program for the current biennium and the three previous biennia. And you have the line at the bottom, which is the number of recipients, and the line at the top, which is again the number of applicants for the grant. And you will notice that the effect of the recession, unfortunately, for the bar on the far right, you have fewer awards in 2009-11. Funding for the program went down, even though the number of applicants has increased rather significantly. Okay. The graph after that gives you a picture of the percentage of students that were able to serve each biennium for the most recent four periods. We have a percentage of applicants getting, this is a percentage of the applicants compared to recipients here. And you'll notice that in the 03-05 biennium and the current biennium, we're serving about the same percentage, about 16-17% of students. And then in the middle 2 years, when funding was a little bit better or when we had fewer applicants, we had a higher percentage of recipients compared to applicants. And then the final slide for the Opportunity Grant Program is essentially a summary of the challenges that we will be facing for the next biennium. The demand continues to be high. The number of FAFSAs that have come in so far this year compared to the same time last year is up about 25%. Resources continue to be limited, not only the general fund and lottery supported funds, but we're also seeing that small amount of federal funding that is included in the Opportunity Grant Program is going to be limited, if not zeroed out completely, in the federal budget for both 2011 and 2012. We also have a changing student population. We have more working students, single or independent older students, and students with higher financial need. And again, we're anticipating no increases in federal funding, either in terms of tax credits or in terms of Pell Grants for the next several years. So I'd be happy to answer any other questions if you have them.
One follow-up, back on slide 11, the percentage of applicants receiving grants, is that primarily, I mean, it could be a sum total of a couple things, I'm guessing, resources available, but some students also just didn't qualify for the grant?
Co-chairs, yes, that is true. It's a combination, and the next slide where we talk about changing parameters and changing eligibility criteria, it's a little bit difficult to do a direct year-to-year comparison because award amounts are different, application deadlines may be different, and the general eligibility criteria may be different year-to-year. So it's a combination of those factors.
Do you have an idea then of how many students who would have met the criteria qualified for the grant that just simply weren't funded because there weren't resources available?
It's large.
Yeah,
I think the last time I looked at the numbers for the current biennium, we were looking at in excess of 100,000 students, well in excess.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. First of all, our offices were filled with a bunch of people yesterday talking about a proposal called tuition equity. I'm assuming that you might be familiar with that. My question is, and the proposal of that is to essentially extend in-state tuition to certain students that have been here and have grown up here in Oregon. Would the Oregon Opportunity Grant be extended to them? Do you know? Are you able to answer that?
Co-chairs, Representative Lindsay, at this point, I do not think so because we do have the federal eligibility requirements. And since we use the FAFSA as the application, the students who are talking about tuition equity at this point would not be able to fill out a FAFSA.
Okay. And then my follow-up question is has your office done any sort of study on how these grants might affect the cost of education, such as tuition, the interrelation between grant and increases of cost and tuition? Has there been any sort of analysis of that?
Co-chairs, Representative Lindsay, we have not done a direct study of that. However, we do have one of our key performance measures does look at the effect of the grant on enrollment, and I think it looks at kind of the gap the gap between financial aid, known financial aid the student has, and what the student's cost of education is, and that gap keeps getting larger.
And maybe just a follow-up statement. The reason why I'm kind of probing here is I'm just wondering, tuition we know is just
doubling, tripling, just going up, and that's actually going up and down in crazy manners, and we're trying to keep up a little bit with this opportunity grant. And I'm just wondering, I'd just like to explore personally how the relation between tuition, if it's more important to focus on controlling tuition hikes versus mm-hmm. focusing time on providing here. And so that was the reason of my probing there.
Okay, question. Any other follow-up?
I have a question. Thanks, Mr. Chair. I would assume that over the years, especially since students who are half-time students became eligible, we've been seeing more community college students using the being eligible for the opportunity grant. Can we see trend lines there in terms of the proportion of the total pot that's going to OUS students, those who are going to independent college students, which are going to community college students, and where are we headed in terms of those trends?
Co-chairs, it's a little difficult to look at trend lines easily because the program changed significantly when we implemented the shared responsibility model for starting with the 2008-2009 academic year. So we only have two and a half academic years worth of data under this new configuration of the program. And for each year that we've had this new program, the parameters of the award amounts in the program have been different. We've had different deadlines, we've had different award amounts, and it makes it a little bit difficult to be able to look at them and compare them directly at this point. What we do know, however, is that the number of community college students overall who have applied for the grant in general or who have filed FAFSAs is significantly higher than it has ever been.
Which is probably a function of the economy.
Definitely a function of the economy, yes.
One challenge I think that community college students face is that they are often entering the system mid-year, mm-hmm. right? And so they're having to go their first year of college without having access to the opportunity grant, right, in many cases, because by the time, let's say, if they've lost their job and they go back to school in the winter or the spring, it's too late for them to apply.
Co-chairs, yeah, that is definitely true. What we suspect is the case this year is that the students got the message that everyone has been telling them to file your FAFSA early, file in January, because we suspect that not only are there more students, but they're also filing for financial aid earlier.
Representative Harker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Given the numbers of applicants and the inability to support many more applicants right now in terms of finances, I'm interested in your thoughts on the advertising that goes on, the billboards that are around. I suspect you spend a very small percentage of the budget on those billboards, but I've had several questions about them.
Co-chairs, Representative Harker, that is actually those billboards are not in our budget at all. Mm. That's completely
different. Some pro bono advertising? Or?
It's a different program. It's a different program, a different funding source.
Can you tell me more?
Yeah. My colleague Vicki Merkel can probably explain it.
Co-Chair Dembro, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. My name is Vicki Merkel, for the record. I'm the Director of Scholarship and Access Programs. And I served on the committee of the first College Access Challenge Grant, which is a federal grant that funded the Opportunities Campaign. And it was funded several years ago. As the economy declined and those billboard spaces were not being sold, they've become pro bono and have been used actually as match for that federal grant. The website that drives, that's advertised on the on the billboards, opportunities.gov. That actually is information for non-traditional students. It's staffed by folks who can answer the phone or do an online chat feature to talk to non-traditional older students, who are those folks you were just mentioning, heading off to community college so they can get specialized attention. So it had a different purpose than bringing business to the Oregon Opportunity Grant.
Thanks.
I might just add, as a corroborating point, we had a billboard up during our campaign along I-84 in Troutdale that is still there because nobody else wants that space. So we're almost ready to take a Sharpie and write in re-collect. So.
Yes. Co-chairs, I'd also like to clarify that the College Access Challenge Grant is administered by the Oregon University Systems, not by OSAC. And there's neither the first iteration of that grant or the second.
Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead, proceed.
I'll move right into the Aspire program. Aspire is a program at OSAC that it creates a network of volunteer support and activities to help high school students and their families access post-secondary education. It is unique in the nation in that we use volunteers. We use adult volunteers, not paid staff, to work one-on-one with students. If you're a student with an Aspire school, you sign up. If you're under 18, you get your parents' permission. And then you have a go-to person. You have your very own adult who's going to help you figure out the process of accessing higher education, where to go and how to pay for it. In addition, OSAC provides the full program. The gentleman you know is Representative Arnie Roblin. I met him when he was Principal Roblin at Marshfield High School in the early years of the Aspire program. And he said what he really appreciated about Aspire was the fact that all the materials came to the school, all the forms. We had thought through the risk management issues, and we could just drop the program in, and it was good to go. The program was designed to be an all-comers program. You don't have to be a high-achieving student. You don't have to be a student who wants to go to a certain type of school. It's for any student for any type of post-secondary education. The impetus was to bring in those mid-range students who really aren't thinking of themselves as college-bound or coming from a family of college-going culture. If you look at the next slide, it says, why do students need Aspire? It's because of all these reasons that they think they can't go. I've always been amazed when I admit that I'm the first in my family to go. I find everywhere around the room there'll be a few other heads that nod. It's not something we really talk about because we always assume everyone else in the room knew how to go. But when your family doesn't have the resources or you don't have the role models to go, you think it's really not for you. It's sort of like this big event on the hill. You don't know how to get the directions. Once you get there, you're not sure how you're supposed to talk or what you're supposed to wear. It's a mystery, and we try to demystify that for students by giving them a one-on-one person that they can go to and talk about what are their aspirations and what sort of school is going to best fit those aspirations, and then how to pay for it.
Quick question. How many schools do we currently have an Aspire program in across the state?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembro, we currently have about 115. The second College Access Challenge Grant that I mentioned a moment ago is funding Aspire to expand to 165 this year, so we're out doing an aggressive recruitment.
And for school to participate, they contact you, you contact them. How does that connection happen?
Both. Absolutely, schools can can contact us. They can get an application from our website, aspireoregon.org. And we're doing recruitment meetings around the state to inform schools. According to our administrative rules, schools do apply to participate. We evaluate their readiness to succeed, particularly with the core of volunteers. Those of you that are parents know you were very welcome in grade school. It was easy to go in and volunteer to grade school. Middle school, you might get to chaperone a dance if you agreed to park a block away. But high school is a whole different thing. Unless you're in an athletic, your kids are in athletics or drama, it's very difficult to get a foot into the school to volunteer. So we're looking at how schools are going to handle having a cadre of volunteers. And what we found anecdotally is generally schools find that they create a lot of support in their community for their schools as more adults come into the building.
Thank you.
This is a fantastic program. I think the kind of example of things that we should do. And 25 years ago, the school I went to had a program like this, and I would not have stayed in college. I probably wouldn't have gotten my degree I probably wouldn't have been here, and how much less entertaining would this committee be? So I just want to say that this is the kind of example of something that is low cost but incredibly valuable in getting students to post-secondary education.
And co-chairs and members of the committee, I do want to draw your attention to who volunteers, because those are the key people that really make that difference. We weren't sure who would come and volunteer with teenagers. Teenagers can be kind of scary. But what we found is we tend to have folks who are maybe parents of younger students, and they know they're going to have to learn this information for their own families. We strongly advise, however, that they never mentor their own children for obvious reasons. And then we found that educators, retired educators, love this program because this is what they meant to do, is to change lives. And sometimes teaching has that effect, and sometimes there's just a lot of other things get in the way. And then people like myself, who are first in their family to go to college and recognize the difference it makes, enjoy reaching out. We've expanded the program I'll talk about in just a moment to include electronic mentoring for those communities where they're not adults readily available. Maybe it's a bedroom community or out in Eastern Oregon, and there's just not someone there. Or for students who need a particular type of mentoring. So, I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't also mention that you would be welcome to apply to be an Aspire electronic mentor. We currently have almost 1,500 volunteers working with students, 1,500 adults who are giving of their time. They're not paid a dime to come in and work with those teenagers. There's a map. It's a little small, but it gives you an idea of where the sites are. Our administrative rule does allow us to have Aspire programs not only at schools, but sites that serve high school students. So we have some non-traditional sites. That could be an alternative school, a homeschooling center, and we're looking at really innovative ways to reach students where they are. The three-year pilot program that I was designed to implement looked at the ability of the program to succeed in a variety of settings, rural, urban, small, large, and we feel that we've been successful. So whether you're a school in Eugene or Portland, or you're in a small area in Southern Oregon or Eastern Oregon, the basic tenets of Aspire will work for you. The next slide talks about the three ways you can aspire at this point. It's the traditional bricks and mortar, we call it, where you sit down with your adult mentor and talk together. Then there's the electronic mentoring, where you are sending emails, but it's through a secured portal where emails can be monitored. Risk management is very important at all times to us. And then we have a pilot program called Getting Ready to Aspire for middle school students. Personally, I think we should be starting in third grade, but at least we're getting closer. Our funding with the College Access Challenge grant, as I mentioned, will allow us to expand to 165. That is a one-year grant currently. It's a federal grant. We hope that it will continue. We hope that the state of Oregon will continue to focus some of that grant on the Aspire program so we can sustain 165. If we don't have that grant in the current proposed governor's budget, we would have one general funded position that will allow us to continue to grant write. Obviously, we've been successful over the years with our grant writing. We had changed our focus to write grants for partnership grants that help the local school hire a site coordinator to coordinate those volunteers. We may have to go back to asking for staff support from grants. The last slide about Aspire shows you some of our current funding partners.
Quick question. Did you say that charter schools would be able to have an Aspire program if they chose to?
Co-Chair Johnson, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
We have Home Source in Bethel, and that's...
Just to wrap up, the Aspire program changes Oregon's future, we believe, by educating students and families about post-secondary education, including financing, which can be a hurdle. If you're not from a family-going culture, you're most likely not going to want to take out loans. That's something we know about those families, so it looks like an impossible task. Creating community investment by building that sustainable core of volunteers who are sincerely interested in the student's future and tend to also become advocates for education, and then cultivating achievement so that students continue to go forward and do great things, as Representative Hoyle attested to how it made a difference in her life. I'd like to move. Are there any further questions about the Aspire program?
Representative Lindsay.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'd just like to pick up what the good representative said here is that Mrs. Roach at my high school is the one that made that individual contact that helped me think about college, and so I really commend the individual approach. But I did have
three questions. Number one is, what is the cost of Aspire? Number two, what happens to Aspire if Senate Bill 242 goes through? And then number three is, do you work with other groups that are similar to Aspire? For example, my church has a webpage called besmart.org, and any high school student or whatever student can go to that website. It tells them all about the different options and really holds their hand and walks them through it from high school. And I'm just wondering if there's some sort of collaboration between similar functioning groups.
Co-chairs, member of the committee. The cost of Aspire to a school is that the school or the site that serves high school students, they have to provide a working space for the volunteers to meet, access to the internet, and then they have to have someone who will coordinate the volunteers. We learned early on that high school counselors who are too busy to help students are too busy to recruit volunteers. Partnership grants, and we have in the current biennium some general funds that provide partnership grants from $1,500 to $3,000. That College Access Challenge grant provides partnership grants at a little bit higher rate, and the schools are asked to match that amount. So for a school, it'll cost $3,000 to $8,000. They can use in-kind for part of their match. To run the program for OSAC, we have implemented a number of strategies to reduce staff time, but it still does take some staff, because in order to maintain program consistency throughout the state, we have region supervisors who go out and do on-site visits and look through and make sure that all the pieces that are supposed to be there are there, that volunteers are being trained, they have the right information, the up-to-date information about financial aid, that sort of thing. And then we also do a lot of our training now online through webinars, so we're not traveling out doing individual training. We do a lot of communication with sites through our portals about who the students are and what sorts of services that they're receiving. So it's a very minimal cost. I don't have the numbers, but I could get to you. The value of the volunteer time, it's pretty outstanding if you were to look at if you had to pay staff to do this one-on-one mentoring. I would defer to Josette for the question number two on the effect of Senate Bill 242.
All right. I'm Josette Green, and co-chairs, and Representative Lindsay. The effect, Senate Bill 242, in essence, indicates that the staff would transfer from our current commission to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. So that bill, I would not see an effect, direct effect on Aspire itself.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, the third question is, do we work with other groups any chance we can get? There's a lot of strategies for helping youth out there and older students, and we'd like to invite them under the tent, so to speak. So sometimes groups like you're talking about will become interested in the program and eventually become Aspire sites. The Nellis Student Success Center in Portland is an example where it's a program funded by a foundation of a student loan organization. They invite students to come in and work at computers and do research. Eventually, they became an Aspire site. We also, if we know of groups that are interested in receiving or learning more about Aspire, we will invite them to our fall training conference, which is held at a campus, and they can come and get a broader view of Aspire as well as specific information. So feel free to give someone my contact information.
Thank you. I want to keep moving along. We are.
I will be very brief about scholarship services. It is another program that is unique to the Oregon Student Assistance Commission. It is a public-private partnership where private foundations and donors put their funds into scholarships for students. We administer more than 400 privately funded scholarships. And we work with the two largest community foundations in Oregon, the Oregon Community Foundation and the Ford Family Foundation. By the way, most scholarships are awarded from funds on interest earnings. So there's millions and millions of dollars that stand behind that $15 million that are awarded in endowments. There's a chart here on the next slide that shows you the total awards in dollars and how they've grown. What's interesting here is that during the economic downturn, and you know what happened to interest rates during the downturn, it went down, but the scholarship dollars remained going up a little bit, staying steady, and that's because new donors came to the party. So there were donors who continued to begin new scholarships, which I think is a fascinating story in this economic times. The scholarship program, we have a feature that is our one application that students can use to search through the 400 scholarships and apply for as many as they are eligible to. We have an online application. We're virtually paperless. 99.9% of our students actually do file online. We have a paper application available for those who need it, but we strongly encourage them to use the e-app. We manage the whole process for the student, including notifying them that they've been awarded, accepting their award letter, and then we disperse the funds to the school. We have a donor development specialist, and in the last few years, we've been laying the foundation for growth, and we feel that we are positioned very well now with our administrative features, such as our electronic application and customized software, to grow to even more scholarships for students. You'll see a few of our partners listed here as well. We work with banks who hold trust funds, employer programs, membership programs, and individual philanthropists. Just trying to do that really fast. Are there any questions for me on the scholarship program?
Okay, co-chairs and committee members, I'm going to talk just for a minute about public programs so that we make sure we have time for my colleague to talk about ODA. The public programs, we have about 1,100, more than 1,100 students who are receiving more than $3 million right now from publicly funded programs. Some of these programs are relatively large, like the Robert Byrd program or the Chafee program. Some of them are federal, some of them are state funded. Some of these programs only have 6 or 7 students in them. Some have 500 or 600 students in them each academic year. We work with a couple of different state agencies to administer some of these programs. Robert Byrd, we work with the Department of Education. GEARUP, we work with the Oregon University System. Chafee, we work with Department of Human Services. Jobs Plus is also through Employment and Department of Human Services, if I'm not mistaken. The Scholarship for Children of Deceased and Disabled Public Safety Officers is actually a very small program. It's administered at OSAC, and it is paid out of funds from the Oregon Opportunity Grant Program. We also administer a couple of loan repayment programs. There are 2 loan repayment programs currently active, Nursing Services and Nursing Educator. They support about 21 recipients at this point, and it's about $180,000, $185,000 that go out to these recipients each year. These are to help people pay back loans that they received in order to become nurses or to become nursing educators. And we also continue to service about 31 outstanding accounts for several expired loan forgiveness programs, some of which have been in existence since the 1980s. So, take your rep, move on.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, I'm Alan Contreras, Administrator of the Office of Degree Authorization. I can't quite match Vicki's auctioneer high-speed voice, but I'm going to be very brief and just give you the quick overview and answer any questions you folks may have. The Office of Degree Authorization, which is generally known as ODA, is a non-financial aid-related program that is housed at OSEC in order to take advantage of the fact that our 7-member commission is a neutral body in the sense that it does not oversee or administer any colleges or universities. And the reason for that has to do with our functions. We have 3 main functions. First, we evaluate and approve degree programs at several different kinds of colleges I'll talk about in a minute. Secondly, we do the investigations and enforcement regarding people who are using diploma mill degrees fake transcripts, things like that. And we work with other enforcement agencies on that kind of work. And finally, we are responsible with the commissioners to mediate conflicts between certain colleges, which is known as the adverse impact process, and I'll chat a little bit more about that here. The main group of colleges we work with are, we have responsibility for all of the for-profit degree-granting institutions in the state of Oregon. We don't handle the small career schools that are non-degree, but we just handle the degree granters. We work with any college that lacks regional accreditation, that wants to operate in the state of Oregon, whether it's a brand new startup here or a school that's from another state that wants to operate here. And we are responsible for the oversight of any colleges that have operated or want to operate in Oregon and have been here for fewer than 5 years. So that's the main group of schools that's under our jurisdiction. Some examples of the schools, the larger ones, would be places like ITT Technical in Portland, University of Phoenix, DeVry, Pioneer Pacific. We also handle HEALD, the Art Institute of Portland, and a small number of religious degree granters that do not have regional accreditation are also under our jurisdiction. There are right now 87 colleges that are under our jurisdiction other than a few religious exempt schools, but that includes a lot that simply have small programs here, or they have like a clinical placement or a practicum located here. We have 27 that we think of as our major customers, which are schools that have full-scale programs on the ground in the state of Oregon that we are responsible for. Our duties include enforcing the law against diploma mills, diploma mill degrees, any kind of bogus academic credential. That includes both credentials that are sold or offered within the United States and those that may be issued in a foreign country and then are presented for use here. We work a lot with other state agencies and a lot of private employers to handle investigations, cases that arise under that law, and to determine whether, in fact, a credential that is purported to be a college degree is, in fact, real. And we do expert testimony on those issues for a lot of agencies and the Oregon Department of Justice. Finally, we are responsible for oversight of what's called the adverse impact process. Once again, this is a process where the commissioners have a very significant role. Under Oregon law, if a public institution wants to start a new degree program, institutions that are already offering such programs from another sector have a right to object on grounds that the program is unnecessary duplication or has an adverse impact upon them. Our office is, if you will, the mediation function for dealing with those cases. I'm pleased to say that we have performed that function well enough that we've only had a couple of cases in the 12 years I've been here that have actually gone as far as the commission for a decision. But in fact, the commissioners that I work for are responsible for deciding these cases eventually according to the standards set by statute and rule. I want to conclude today by just thanking you folks for the 12 years of great support that I've had from you and your predecessors. I will be retiring from state service in about 6 weeks, and it's just been great to be able to do my job the way I think it ought to be done. Working with folks have always been very, very supportive, so thank you. I have nothing else. Be glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Contreras?
I do. Thanks, Mr. Chair, Ellen, and I can't not take this opportunity to thank you for those years of service and really putting Oregon on the map in terms of as being a place of really high credibility. And I still have on my refrigerator at home your sheepskin, magnet.
Mr. Co-Chair, there's plenty more on the table in the back of the room. If anybody needs an extra sheep, it's been one of our more popular items. An Oregon artist did the sheep, by the way, too. So
thank you.
And it's been great working with you, too, sir.
Great, thanks. I'd like you, if you would, just to clarify for us a little more the difference between the schools that your office oversees and the career schools that offer certificates. Next week we're going to be hearing some bills or talking about some bills that have to do with career schools. So what exactly is the difference?
Well, the Office of Degree Authorization, which is the two-person unit that I am responsible for overseeing, is the agency that evaluates and approves any degree granting programs in the state of Oregon, and certain certificates and diplomas that are issued by degree-granting colleges. In other words, you can be a degree-granting college, but you can also maybe offer a certificate or two. If you are operating a school that does not offer any degrees at all, Barber College, Beauty College, some of the computer schools, that kind of thing, all of those schools, there's I think 300 or 400 of them, are called private career schools. They are under the jurisdiction of the Oregon Department of Education. It's Teresa Green's office. And we work closely with them all the time, because sometimes a school starts out as one, wants to become the other, switches back and forth. We've had them go in both directions over time. So that is the distinction, is whether or not they issue a degree. And one reason for that is that if you are a degree-granting entity, then you are, among other things, you are generating academic credits under a system we're all familiar with, that can be transferred around to other degree-granting institutions. That is generally not true of career schools, and that's one reason why it's split up the way it is.
Thank you.
All right. I'll wrap up here. Josette Green, co-chairs Dembro and Johnson, in committee. Thank you so much for your engagement. I know we have exceeded the time you've asked of us, and I appreciate that you still continue to be here with us. We were also asked to comment on trends that we see nationally and statewide. I won't go into detail. You have that information there. I would say one trend is definitely applications are up nationally and within our state. It was anticipated that nationally it would be a 10% increase. This state's already experiencing a 25% increase. So applications are up around the nation. In the state, then, we're experiencing our opportunity grant awards. We've continued to decline. As well, what's also in decline is the percent of applicants that we're able to serve. So some trends to share with you. This office is moving forward in a very positive way. Again, we're well aligned with our governor in supporting the efforts to get our Oregonians onto higher education. Definitely we support the 40-40-20 bill and want to put our effort out there. I want you to know that we're here. We're ready to go to even further commitment in this very, very important mission for the state of Oregon. So I will close here. You'll see we also have websites. By the way, we have a new design of a website coming out shortly, and a new website name, which better aligns and is better, more user-friendly for our students, called OregonStudentAid.gov. A lot better than OSAC.state.gov. So that's coming up very shortly. Again, thank you so much for your engagement today and for the time with you, and we look forward to your questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for our panel? We did okay as we went along.
Thank you.
Thank you, all of you. Very good report. We'll go ahead and call up now Mark Richardson. Can we address the panel, please? Or the committee?
Thank you, Co-Chairs Dembro, Johnson, committee members. My name is Dr. Mark Richardson. I am Dean of the School of Medicine at OHSU, and I'm pleased to be here today to talk a little bit about healthcare education. I know we didn't have a PowerPoint to follow in our first, and I apologize for utilizing PowerPoint slides, but I think it will help guide at least a portion of the discussion today. I do want to acknowledge that you're also following me, going to hear a great deal of data about healthcare workforce needs that I think will document some of the things that I'm going to talk about today. But I think we can go ahead and begin by acknowledging that there is a problem that we're all facing related to the lack of healthcare providers, not only in this state and region, but across the country. not only do we not have enough people, I think, to provide the health care that we need, but they're not well distributed geographically, certainly in this state and in the U.S. in general. We also have an aging workforce, increasing demand, and certainly given healthcare reform and what's happening with the perturbations in payment and delivery, that is also creating instability in terms of providers. Because we compete with that shortage of healthcare providers, we're competing with other states as well. And another factor to include in your thoughts as you begin to wrestle with this is the amount of debt that our students have. And you just listened to, I think, a great presentation about trying to provide assistance. Multiply that to, I think, a larger extent, and you can see some of the factors which influence geographic distribution and specialty decisions related to at least our medical school population. Most of our healthcare models are designed to meet past social needs, and I think I'd couple that by saying also that our revenue sources to help fund that educational models are designed on past revenues that we probably don't have available to us anymore. And I think we need to rethink how we fund education and, again, what we're trying to accomplish with the healthcare provider of the future. We need to think about what will our society need, focus on the education continuum, especially with the idea of team-based and interprofessional learning. I think the lifelong learning issue that we've heard about for a long time is particularly germane to healthcare, where things change rapidly over time and a need for continuing education is paramount if we're going to deliver the quality of education that our constituents deserve. This is just a slide to show that given our demographics that we're facing, an aging population, especially in this state, the need and demand for services clearly rises after age 65. And as we continue to age, that demand curve continues to increase. I'm going to try to be as general as I can, but obviously my frame of reference is OHSU, and most of my comments will be directed towards the healthcare education that we are responsible for. We do have a statewide mission. Our mission statement contains four primary goals and objectives. It is related to teaching, discovery, healing, and of course outreach to all portions of our state. We take that mission very seriously and try to make sure that every time we make decisions, whether it's about our clinical care system, about research, or about teaching, we include the outreach portion of that mission in making decisions. The components of at least OHSU are pretty complicated, and for some of you who may not be familiar with OHSU, I wanted to mention specifically some aspects of it. Our healthcare organization, of course, is our hospital and clinic, but there's also the Center for Women's Health, the Children's Hospital, our Child Development and Rehabilitation Center. We have our academic programs, the School of Dentistry, Medicine, Nursing, Allied Health, and the OSU College of Pharmacy. Our research centers, institutes, and schools, partially funded, certainly with the help of the Oregon Opportunity, but those would include the CROIT, VOLUM, the Vaccine and Gene Therapy Institute, the Primate Center, the Advanced Imaging Center, the Knight Cancer Institute, and of course we have a large number of outreach organizations, including AHEC, ORPRIN, the Poison Center, and again the CDRC, which delivers care in many places outside of Portland. I want to specifically point out that although our facilities are primarily in Portland, we think of ourselves as a statewide institution. And in fact, if you look, if you just think about this big square as being Oregon, we have a family medicine resident and student up here in Enterprise. We have dietitians down in Medford. We have PAs over here in Ontario. So almost every county in Oregon certainly has parts of OHSU as a constituent in terms of providing education, training, and service. And we think that's important not only for our state, but for OHSU so that it can maintain its relevancy to the population here. I think we are making a difference across Oregon. Not only do we have those individual practitioners, but you'll see later that we have our AHEC centers, which are divided up into different areas of our state. We have nursing outreaches that go across our state as well. So, again, I think we are making a difference. I want to just briefly talk about funding. And this is a slide, I think, that is important not because so much of these figures here, gifts, grants, and contracts, and patient services, but what's happened over time with these smaller slices of revenue. So this proportionality that you see here is actually much more like a private institution than a public institution. We have had diminished funding from the state. Our gifts, grants, and contracts have actually increased, and the proportion of patient care has increased. And of course, our overall overall revenue picture has changed remarkably since the institution of the public corporation back in 1995. Our total budget has quadrupled since that period of time. And again, the primary changes have occurred up here in terms of a growth in our NIH funding and a diminishment in the state funding. As we do that, as we change our funding sources, that creates challenges for us. And I want to specifically acknowledge that there's a cost shift that takes place as a result of what you've seen on that prior slide. We use funding from our patient care enterprise to help support the educational missions, our outreach missions, and of course we have used the Oregon Opportunity Bonds to expand our research capacity and promote technology transfer. But that's an important thing, I think, for everybody to recognize, is that's part of how OHSU works, that cost shift. We have four primary schools, the schools of dentistry, nursing, medicine, and pharmacy. We are the only higher education system in Oregon offering doctoral degrees in medicine, dentistry, and nursing. We have approximately 4,000 students that finish, that are in our schools every year, with about 1,700 faculty. We are the largest GME trainer in Oregon. And let me just explain to you who don't know what graduate medical education is. After a student receives his MD, they are not qualified to deliver care. They must go through additional training, graduate education, to decide on a specialty of medicine, whether that's primary care or OBGYN or neurosurgery. We provide that training along with others, but we are certainly the largest trainer of graduate medical education. 60% of all of our degrees are awarded to Oregon residents. We offer continuing education for approximately 23,000 professionals every year, and one-third of all of Oregon physicians completed part of their or all of their training at OHSU. There are a number of collaborative programs that we have established and participate in across, again, the educational enterprise of Oregon. You've heard me reference OSU. We have certainly our College of Pharmacy, which is based at OHSU, is actually an OSU program. We also partner with OSU around a degree in public health, as well as a combined OSU-PSU-MBA program. We have a significant number of combined programs with PSU, including, again, the MPH and a specific healthcare MBA. We share biochemistry professors and faculty. So there's a great deal of collaboration with OSU and PSU. The Oregon Institute of Technology Allied Health Programs uses OHSU as a training site. And of course, we have our OCNI nursing programs that are distributed among eight community colleges. We're particularly proud of that Oregon Collaborative Nursing Education Program because it actually was one of the first in the country that was able to actually collaboratively decide on a curriculum and be able to move credits from one institution to another and actually allow individuals who want to take time off or have to take time off because of financial reasons to re-enter school at their capability and not lose those credits and proceed to finish their educational curriculum on time. I want to also emphasize that we are especially highly regarded across the country for our nursing programs and our medicine programs, especially as it relates to primary care. These things are important to us. And one thing that you I think everybody always recognizes OHSU for its medicine and nursing programs, but are not as well aware of some of the other programs that we have related to our physician assistance programs and other things, which I'm going to cover in just a minute here. But our physician assistant program has been in existence since 1994, is highly regarded throughout the country, and provides 40 additional primary care providers to Oregon, or at least the Northwest, every year. One of the things that came as a little bit of a surprise to us, this was an unsponsored study that looked at the fulfillment of social mission. Social mission was evaluated on the basis of diversity and providing the number of physicians that are needed in the region. So that's, again, primary care is the focus for this, and we actually rank number 11 across the country, despite actually I think the amount of diversity which is present in this state. So we do fairly well. Again, a large, well-established school with 7 basic science departments, 20 clinical departments, large numbers of students, 780 training spots for our graduate medical education program, which includes 190 positions in primary care. Our continuing medical education program is highly sought after, and we have currently 12,000 alumni across Oregon. So let me talk just a little bit about some of the specific programs that we do have. Some of you may not be aware that we have a large graduate studies program. That graduate studies program is obviously important, especially as it relates to our PAs, a number of radiation therapists, masters in public health, other master's programs related to biomedical informatics, clinical research, clinical nutrition, and et cetera. Those graduate studies are actually important for our basic scientists. Without pre-doctoral students and some postdoctoral students, those laboratories cannot function. They really rely not only on the educational process, but the ideas that are surfaced among those students to help foster discovery in their labs. And in 2008, OHSU and OGI, specifically the School of Medicine portion of OHSU, merged, and they are now a department within the School of Medicine. Last year, we've actually had, despite the number of challenges facing us and facing all of us, I think, we actually had the largest number of graduates we've ever had. So despite all of the challenges relating to funding, we've continued, I think, to fulfill our primary mission. So this past year, 77% of all of our entering MD class is Oregonian. We currently rank 10th in the country for retention of our graduate medical education. All of our residents who have trained here, we have a high rate of them wanting to stay in Oregon once they're finished. We have an active rural scholars and rotation program. As I mentioned, 35 graduates from our PA program. And I wanted to talk just briefly about a couple of programs. Yes.
Just a minute.
I just have a quick question about you know, the percentage of students. Earlier was 60%. Here it's 77 of those entering the MD class. How do you define Oregonian? That is it someone who's grown up here in Oregon, or is it somebody who just happens to be living here at the time that they apply for medical school?
Co-Chair Jimbo, thank you for asking the question. So we use, as Oregonian, official residence is here. There are many of our students who apply from California who technically may have a residence elsewhere, who really have family roots in Oregon. They're considered Californians. Those individuals who move to Oregon and establish residence here, we consider as Oregonian. That 60% figure that you saw earlier really related to all of the students at OHSU versus OHSU, excuse me, versus the School of Medicine.
Correct. Just a follow-up. I wonder if we could get information, the number of students who have graduated from an Oregon high school who, you know, are students at OHSU. That would be useful. Just, you know, in part, one of our goals is, you know, we're working as a legislature to try to, you know, expand options and access for Oregonians to higher education. That's a question I would be interested in knowing.
Co-Chair Jimbo, I will try to ascertain that information for you and provide it to the committee. Thank you for asking the question. I did want to mention just these three programs specifically because they're things which you don't ordinarily associate with OHSU, and I think they're representative of the healthcare professional workplace and something that I think is important to all of us. I'm going to talk about medical physics. Medical physics is a part of oncology services. So if you have cancer and you've received radiation therapy, you've had to deal with a physicist at some point. They're the ones who actually set up the machinery that allow the appropriate dosing to be delivered to a cancer focus. And currently, this is a new program for OHSU. It started 4 years ago. This is the only program in the Northwest. We take 2 to 3 graduates, 2 to 3 students every year. And right now, every student that is finishing our program already has a place to go. This means that they're sought after by every hospital system that has any kind of beam therapy, because these are the people that set up the beam and are able to do it. Our bioinformatics program is another program that has been of recent origin. The projected need for bioinformatics personnel on a national level is 100,000 over the course of the next 5 years. That's because of the proliferation of the electronic medical record, which has been part of the stimulus program. You need people to manage that, people to set it up, and people to analyze the data that it generates. And so this is a new program, again, that we've developed to answer a need that I think everybody can see. The last program is another one I don't think that you may be aware of. Dietetics is an important program. This is actually an old program at OHSU. It's 80 years old. We are one of the few programs, again, west of the Mississippi who provides a program in dietetics. Dietetics is that science of nutrition that actually applies to inpatient facilities. How do we manage diets for the range of individuals who are present in a hospital with a variety of metabolic diseases, some of whom may be in the ICU, some of whom may have incredibly special dietetic needs, and that all needs to be based on science. How do you develop the food that's actually going to fulfill those nutritional needs? There are actually 18 to 20 graduates every year from this program. About 66% of those graduates end up staying in Oregon and working either in hospital facilities or other clinical facilities in terms of providing nutritional support to the patients and individuals that they treat. I can't do justice to the nursing program the way that Michael Bly can, but I'll do my best. We have a well and highly recognized, well-developed, highly recognized nursing program that began back in 1919. I will not go through all of the letters here, but I do want to go through our specialty nursing programs up here, the post-master certificate programs, because we have a number of those, seven specialty areas, including gerontology, pediatrics, oncology, and really these specialty nurses are incredibly important in terms of part of our care provision of the future. I mentioned OCNI and the number of sites among community nursing schools that we interact with. Primarily, the focus for OHSU is the development of doctoral programs. Doctoral programs are incredibly important because right now nursing education has to be delivered by doctoral degree nurses. And so we feel like that is our primary responsibility at Markham Hill, is to make sure that we are training enough PhDs to handle the training needs in the remainder of our state. As you can see, we have a high number of Oregonians within that program that we're very proud of.
One quick question.
Surely.
Representative Hoyle.
Representative Hoyle?
I know that it's really a challenge to get people that can teach nursing, and one of the bigger issues, from what I understand, is that you can make more being a practicing nurse in many areas than you get paid to teach nursing. Could you address that a little bit? What are we doing to make sure that we have enough teachers so that we can have the appropriate healthcare professionals for primary care access?
Representative Hoyle, I don't have the answer to that question. I think one of the reasons that we're successful at OHSU is we have people who believe in the missions that we're trying to accomplish, that it's not just about education or clinical care, but it is about research, and it's actually about the linking of those missions together that helps provide the professional fulfillment that they want to have. I think we all know, everybody in this room knows, that there are things that we could do that would probably provide more monetary reward than we're currently obtaining. At least I think we'd all like to think so. So I don't have a good answer. Can I tell you honestly that we're trying to make our salaries competitive? Certainly we are, but there's a limit given the situation that we're all facing right now. Again, large scope. This program, the School of Nursing, does have a clearly a statewide scope, and I think really is doing its best to serve the community needs. I know that our Healthcare Workforce Committee has looked at nursing shortages. They do vary by county, as do physician shortages, and clearly the nursing shortage is the number one priority if you look across the state. And here are the OCNI sites. Again, you can see the wide distribution throughout Oregon for where those are located. I cannot do justice to the School of Dentistry either, but I will try. That should be Dean Clinton's objective here. Again, well-recognized a well-developed program, 65% Oregonian, postdoctoral students engaged in many specialty areas of dentistry, including pediatrics and oral surgery, highly sought after program with many more applicants than places within the first year class. And again, a large proportion of those alumni are located primarily in the Northwest. There is a good distribution of what our dental school is trying to accomplish. And again, I think a primary outcome is that two-thirds of dentists in Oregon have graduated from OHSU. AHECs, our Area Health Education Centers, are really one key element that we have for providing a distributive education model for us. They help us with our rural training experiences to our medical students, rural training for our family medicine residents, large numbers of emergency services provided. One thing I think that you would likely be interested in is that we do help provide an exposure to students in those AHEC areas about the health professions, and certainly try to encourage them to enter the health professions. The AHEC centers also provide a site for not only allopathic but osteopathic medical students, and of course dental, nursing, pharmacy, and RPA students as well. The AHEC centers not only look at the educational process but the recruitment and retention of physicians to practice in rural areas through faculty development, as well as the local locum tenens program. And here are our five AHEC areas that we currently support. OHSU is held to a number of performance metrics, and I'm not going to try and go through all of those. I'm going to go through some of those. And again, I think what you'll see is that we have had funding challenges, which have occasionally compromised our ability to meet those performance standards, and they're currently affecting our ability to meet those performance standards. Here is the percent of first-year medical school positions filled by Oregon residents. You can see back here in 08 that we dropped down significantly as a result of funding challenges. You can also see that 9 came back up. I think we were 72% in 9, and then last year we were 78%, 77%, and this year we're on target to clear that 70% bar as well. We are well above the numbers that were prescribed by the legislature. We will be admitting, this year we admitted 124 students. This upcoming year we will admit 128 students.
Mr. Richardson?
Yes.
If I might just stop you there for a bit. You're giving an excellent report. We're going to maybe have to wrap up. But what I would like to do possibly is invite you back again at a subsequent opportunity. We're going to have a PSU people here coming up, but it might be an opportunity for you guys to collaborate on some. I know you guys have worked together
with
some stuff too, and it might have you do that. But we have a few questions I think we'd like to get into.
Certainly.
Perhaps while we still have you here, Representative Hoyle.
Out of the doctors that will be graduating, medical school students that will be graduating, what percentage of medical degree of your students go into primary care?
So there are two questions that I think that you're asking, actually. One is 40% of them, or a little bit better than 40%, will actually enter primary care. Primary care actually consists of pediatrics, family medicine, and internal medicine. Some of the internal medicine and some of the pediatricians may actually go on to subspecialize within those disciplines. The answer that I think you want is how many end up in primary care, and the answer there is about 30%. That's actually much higher than the national percentage, and we feel good about that 30% figure.
I have a couple questions as well. You are the only approved medical school in Oregon, is that correct?
Actually, there's another medical school in Oregon now, the College of Osteopathic Medicine of the Pacific.
Oh, okay.
Is a medical school.
Okay. With the need for additional MDs, if you will, across our state and so forth, would you see a need for another one within our university system right now at this point in time?
We have plans through the Collaborative Life Sciences Building to increase our class size to 160. So I guess my answer is I think the combination of osteopathic school and our increase in class size will answer at least one aspect of the physician shortage. But remember, right now there are other stumbling blocks. First of all, do we have the appropriate number of students in high school and colleges in Oregon who will qualify for those slots in a medical education program? And then the other slice is, where do we train them in graduate medical education? Right now, many of our students, many of our graduates, have to leave Oregon to find places to do their graduate medical training. And in fact, in most states, where you do your residency is where you end up practicing. So I'd say I think we actually are doing reasonably well at the number of MDs that we're going to produce. It's where do they go after they finish their education, and where do we get them to fill the pipeline that are problems that I think we also need to address with equal attention.
Okay. And I know Pacific, I think, offers a PA program as well, though.
They do.
Are there other locations in Oregon?
I don't think there are any other PA programs in Oregon that I'm aware of at this time.
One other question. Could you talk about the Oregon Opportunity Bonds and how OHSU has used those to expand and to provide the product you're offering?
They have been a tremendous benefit to us in terms of our growth and expansion. I'd have to go back and pull out some a little bit different revenue slides for you to look at our overall growth, but you can see our gifts, grants, and contracts going from 20% to almost 38% as a result of the research investment that we've made.
Maybe we can find out more about that at a later time as well, but you know, Representative Lindsay.
Actually, I'll ask it another time. Thanks. Okay. I think we're running on to a different one, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
I'll catch up another time.
If we could just, I'm sorry to switch gears here. We have some other folks that would like to talk about similar topic today, and I know that was difficult to fit them in, so I want to make sure we can get to them. But certainly invite you back again, maybe to finish the discussion and go on. Oh, a question for Representative Harker.
Quick question, I think. If not, we can take it up another time. What did you mean by the question? I'm going to paraphrase here, but the question of do we have the high school students and the college students to fill those slots?
So if you look at, thank you for asking that question, committee member Harker. What I mean by that is that actually when you look at the admission profile to OHSU for the School of Medicine, mm-hmm. the number of qualified applicants from Oregon has really changed very little over the past 10 years. So we have, on average, approximately 350 to 400 qualified applicants every year. Now, the number, just as you heard in the previous presentation, has increased with the economic times. That's a very common process. People look to medicine as sort of a stable work environment in troubling times. But in fact, that number between 360 and 400 has been very consistent for the past 10 years. So our ability to actually select outstanding students is really sort of capped by that particular factor. We need more Oregonians, I think, to excel within our educational system.
I was hoping you'd say that.
I'm glad I fulfilled your expectations.
In fact, relationship between diploma requirements in our K-12 environment and numbers of students who are qualifying for programs like yours. Yeah, there's an effect there. So, thank you. Appreciate
thank you for the ability to address your committee.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, our next guests, Sean Colmer and Joe Isgrig. For the record, committee, we can go over in this committee room if we need to. If you guys have to leave at 3, we perfectly understand that. So, thank you.
Don't open that door.
Yeah.
That's dangerous.
Yeah, I know. School's out.
Co-chairs Johnson and Dembro, first of all, for the record, Sean Colmer, Deputy Administrator, Office of Health Policy and Research of the Oregon Health Authority. First, thank you for having us here. I think this is the first opportunity the Health Authority has had to address this committee, so that's nice. It's also nice that this isn't Ways and Means, because this is the Ways and Means room sometimes. So, again, thanks for that. We'll try to be brief, and for any other questions you might have, feel free to contact us at any time. Joining me is our resident expert in Oregon, Joe Isgrig, the Executive Director of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute. So I think some of the conversations you had for Dean Richardson would be applicable to ask us, and we can collectively answer some of those questions, not all of them. So I'll run through the slides that you have in front of you fairly briefly, and then Joe will talk a little bit about some of the data that we have in Oregon and talk to some of the issues that you all are going to be dealing with in Oregon. First of all, just as a reminder for some about what the Health Authority is, we are the state agency now that sort of combines 5 existing state agencies to take care of most of the health and healthcare-related issues in Oregon. We now purchase healthcare for over 850,000 lives in Oregon. As part of that process, we were trying to reduce duplication and work within existing resources to make the state a smart purchaser of healthcare, especially in these budget environments. The Health Authority is led by a 9-member governor-appointed Senate-confirmed board, and they recently have delivered to you the action plan for health, which you received in December, which includes some workforce recommendations that I'll talk a little bit about today. This is the mission and the strategies that guide not only the board, but the Health Authority and the work that it does. And having to work on all 3 of these aspects in anything that we're doing. 1, improve the lifelong health of Oregonians, increase the quality, reliability, availability of care for all Oregonians, and then, especially in these times, lower or contain the cost of care so it's affordable to everyone. So I think the important piece here is it's not just about the 850,000 lives that we directly control purchasing for, but all Oregonians. How do we use our purchasing power and our ability to change policy to impact everybody and make Oregon a better place to deliver care? As part of House Bill 2009 from the 2009 legislature that created the Health Authority and the Policy Board, it created a Healthcare Workforce Committee. So that's a statutory committee. The membership is broad. It has educators, providers, employers, advocates, certifiable smart people about workforce issues, some foundations, really a great collection of people who are really passionate about not only the healthcare side of things, but also the education side of things and how we work together to create a synergistic workforce policy in the state. They delivered, as part of their work, recommendations that then fed into the action plan that you received, and you also received, as part of the materials we provided today, the full report from the Workforce Committee that has sort of their long-term vision of what they'd really like to work on. I'll go ahead and hand it off to Joe.
Thank you. Co-Chair Stotson, Dembro. For the record, my name is Joe Isgrig. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute. I'm going to give you a very brief high-level overview of some of the data that the Healthcare Workforce Committee looked at. Before I do that, I wanted to share with you this data. You're seeing it publicly first before the Healthcare Committee, or the Healthcare Workforce Committee. But I wanted to share this data with you in terms of the economic contributions of Oregon's healthcare workforce to Oregon's economy. As part of the committee's effort, some of the committee members had asked, the workforce committee members had asked for information regarding the contributions of the healthcare workforce to the economy. So the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, in partnership with the Oregon Employment Department, did a study and pulled the data found these numbers with regards to our workforce contributions in 2008. That was the most recent year that we have all of the data available. So what we found was in 2008 there were over 186,000 jobs in the healthcare industry. That's hospitals, nursing homes, residential care facilities, and all the ambulatory healthcare services like outpatient clinics, hospice, home health programs. And then we would take the next ripple effect. We see that there's over 325,000 jobs created as a result of those jobs. Those are people such as accounting firms, janitorial firms, medical equipment suppliers that support the healthcare industry. And it also includes the induced jobs. That's the jobs that are created because households with income earned from the healthcare industry go out and purchase groceries, get their automobile repaired, buy a new car, or get their dry cleaning done. And that in essence is about 14% of our state's labor pool. That's a significant amount when we think about the economy's role. And those jobs contribute $23.3 billion to the economy, and that was in 2008. And I believe in 2008, our state's GDP was $161 billion. So that, again, this is a significant chunk of the state's economy. And then because of those jobs, $1.98 billion came back to the state and local counties through taxes as a result of this employment. So I wanted to share that with you with regards to your decisions and thinking about your investments. I want to go just very briefly through some of the data that the committee looked at. We know through the Oregon Employment Department projections between 2008 and 2018, we need over or about 58,000 new jobs, new healthcare workers in this state. That means more than or about half of the number of dentists and dental hygienists that we have, over 40% of the physicians, lab techs, social workers, OTs, and 41% of our registered nurses. Now, just registered nurses alone in sheer numbers, it's about 13,000 registered nurses that we need. Thinking about that. There we go. In terms of the industry itself, we're seeing projections for the ambulatory care, the hospital, and the nursing home industry is projected to grow. And in this economy, it has weathered the storm better than many of the other sectors. But what these projections don't take into account are the changes to our delivery system that are coming as a result of the reform. So we have new roles that will be coming out for our healthcare workforce, and we need to understand what that's going to mean. We have significant recruitment and retention challenges. shortages with regards to physicians and nurses in particular. And then we have emerging roles in occupations in terms of, particularly in terms of our health information technology workforce, bioinformaticists, medical informaticists, nursing informaticists. We don't really know what our projected needs are going to be. And then certainly because of increases in the number of people who are going to be covered by health insurance, that's also going to create a demand. So some of that information is not included in these projections, but we still need to know about it. Dr. Richardson alluded to our aging workforce. That's one of the three major drivers of the demand for health care, the other being our growing population and our aging population. But when we look at these 17 different occupations, the yellow and orange lines are those people who are 55 years of age and over. And that's pretty significant for some of our nursing workforce, our physicians and dentists. This means we have to replace a lot of people who are thinking about reducing the number of hours that they're working or planning on retiring in the future. And then what we know in terms of our information about the number of graduates, and you received an electronic copy of a document that we produced for the Oregon Workforce Investment Board that looked at the graduate supply from some of our high-demand health professions occupations. We know that the graduates are not keeping pace with the supply. That means Oregon has to recruit, if they're able to. We have to recruit health professionals from outside of the state. So there are major factors that are affecting our ability to meet that demand. Number one is our educational program capacity, and as Dr. Richardson alluded to, we've got some clinical training capacity issues. We don't have enough sites beyond physicians, but that's also for nurses and EMTs and pharmacists and physical therapists. That's for most of our healthcare occupations. We also have faculty shortage, not just in nursing, which is pretty well documented, but also in physical therapy, pharmacy, and others where in industry they are able to earn more money than as a teacher. You heard about the Aspire program earlier today, and scholarships and loan repayment programs are very important in helping to recruit students into programs. And then, once again, the academic preparation in K through 12, particularly in terms of our math and science courses. We're not doing our students are not getting the math and science that they need to make them qualified to get into programs or schools where they could develop the credentials to further their education, certainly to become into medical school or other programs.
Quick question about that. I wondered if you all had a chance to interact with ODE in regards to their new K-12 diploma requirements that are now being unveiled and students will be graduating with these requirements under the belt, so to speak, in 3 years, I think.
So we have worked with the Oregon Department of Education, certainly in terms of their health occupations programs, but we haven't seen the effects of those yet on students coming out of schools and applying for college yet. So we'll be looking at that. And then the other component of an adequate supply is certainly that we have diverse students who are going to be filling slots in our healthcare workforce that represent our population as well. And with that, as Dean Richardson's slides showed, health reform equals education reform. That means we also have to change our curriculum to address the changes that are coming, not only in terms of reform, but also in terms of technology. So all of our health professional students need to be computer literate. They're not all of them are, but they need to have some basic computer skills so that they can run electronic health records. They need to be culturally competent, and they need to be flexible in their roles. So that means being able to step outside in an acute care situation and work in a community setting as well.
So what I'll do in the interest of time is just go right to two of the recommendations from the policy board that I think affect the work here. First is around standardizing sort of the administrative requirements for clinical placement. I think Dean Richardson made that comment earlier today. There's a very successful program in Portland right now led by the Oregon Center for Nursing around nursing placement. Essentially, how do we standardize those sort of basic things like immunizations, background checks, so students don't have to do it multiple times, and also from a clinic perspective or a facility perspective, how do they know what to trust? So again, really sort of taking a local model and figuring out how we can move that to a statewide model to then open up clinical placements, open up the pipeline around after someone's qualified academically and they need experience, where can they go? So that's one. Yeah,
Sean, I have a question for you.
Sure.
And I think this is really a great idea. I know that finding clinical placements is a huge challenge. I wonder, is there any work going on with doing this on a regional basis, that is, where all of the schools come together and kind of coordinate their placements? Is that happening? And I bring that up. I was on a tour of ITT Tech in Portland last summer, and they were just beginning a nursing program there, and they were saying that they were facing some challenges with clinical placements, which didn't surprise me because I know the challenges. Is there some possibility for planning these things?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembro, I think that's exactly what's happening in Portland right now around the nursing stuff. And I think that what we heard at the committee is some of these conversations have been happening, but that OHA could really play a role at bringing everybody together to really make it happen. I think people want to do that. They might not know how or have the right people around the table to sort of make it happen. So that's the intent of this recommendation from the policy board.
Thank you.
And I think the second one is what you heard a little bit about earlier, and you had an expert in the room to talk about that, so I won't claim to be. But some of the conversations of the committee from the community college side specifically was around the good intentions of this policy, but what is the impact right now in a system where we need to ramp up the pipeline for local communities, for team-based approaches. So really taking another look at this from a reform environment, from a team-based care environment, and see if there's either statutory changes that need to happen or if it's just rule changes. We're not quite sure, but we need a really deep dive in this policy to make sure that all of our educational institutions, whether they're public or private, have the opportunity to fulfill a need that students are asking for. And with that, there's our contact information, and I'll entertain any other questions.
Those are the cliff notes.
There we go. 5 minutes to spare.
You guys are good. Follow-up?
I do think, following up on Representative Dembro's comments about some sort of regional and clinical sites, seems to be a real glaring need in the system. I think it'd be interesting to follow up on that concept and see what's been thought about and what would be required in order to bring that to pass. Obviously, there are requirements in terms of what type of facility there'd have to be existing and what sort of facilitators and trainers and all that sort of stuff, but I'm sure you guys have done some research on that. But
Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Dembro, actually, the Oregon Department of Community College and Workforce Development is trying to orchestrate some effort around that, looking at a particular community or one particular occupation that we can start with a pilot project. And as you can imagine, this does require a lot of stakeholders to come into the conversation, and certainly the work around the Oregon Center of Nursing did around this for nursing in the Portland area certainly serves as a model for that. There's interest in this from a variety of different people, but it's being able to address the complexity. And also, in coordinating the clinical sites, the Oregon Center for Nursing has a Student Max program, which is a software database that helps manage those. And it allows for coordination, and if there's an empty slot, another school can step in and take a slot. To be able to do that outside of Portland will take a lot of trust among the stakeholders to be able to share clinical sites.
One last question. In the body of recommendations, the group of recommendations that you're making, are there any that are going to require some legislation? It sounds like the adverse impact, perhaps. Is there something you want us to do aside from providing more resources, obviously, for loan forgiveness programs and other really important
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembro, we do believe both of these recommendations, they are going to be a bill over on the Senate side, starting over in Senator Amanda Sanderson's committee. We don't necessarily need legislation, but I think part of the push for this is really use legislation to get the stakeholders around the table and really decide how we move this work forward, because there's been a lot of interest. But again, as Joe was saying, a lot of trust that still needs to be built with stakeholders to make this happen. Yep.
Thank you.
Yep.
Very good. Well, it's a lot of information today. Thank you guys for your attention, and thank you all who have presented today. I appreciate that. We'll go ahead and close our informational meeting for today and adjourn until our next meeting on Thursday.